I'm a walker, so if I'm chained to a podium, I'm even more of an insomniac's delight than the average economist is. So I think you want me to be a little animated up here, and I think you also want it because what an act to follow. And it's not an act. I didn't mean to say that. It's not an act. But it's very tough to stand up here after such inspiration. And what can I possibly say that's, you know, going to inspire after that? The only thing that I think I have in common with your presentation is that I have two adopted kids as well. We went to Russia in 99 and then in 2001 again because my wife and I saw, well, there's 500,000 orphans inside of Russia and we want to do just our little bit. And of course, it was partly selfish, you know, for no discernible reason, we couldn't have kids. And we thought, well, we want to have a family and we can't have kids. And there's a lot of needy kids out there. So we're going to go ahead and do this. And so that's the only overlap that I have. Like I said, you know, usually the economist is brought up because you haven't, you know, had a whole lot of sleep lately. And so this is your opportunity. If you're jet lagged or anything like that, here we go. And, you know, I realized partway through the last presentation, not because there was anything dull about it in the least bit, but I thought, you know, I got this nagging feeling that something might be wrong here. And so I checked my sent items. And true enough, my deck didn't get through to Rick. And I didn't ask him, like, did you receive that thing? I just presumed that it was there. And I see by up on the screen there is a deck.
Yeah, it's all done.
A miracle. Okay, so I thought it was going to be even worse. I'm going to have to talk to you. Not only do I put people to sleep, but I got no deck to you for you to look at while I put you to sleep. So anyway, so that's a great relief to me. I do, you know, half of the time I speak with no deck. And sometimes I have a deck, and that'll be really useful to us. So that's great. Don't move it. Great. I get to move it. I'm a control freak, so... So economics and seeing the world and the relevance of that to a Christian entrepreneur, how do we put all of that together? Well, at one point in time, I thought to myself, are there any economists in the Bible? And I looked through and I thought, well, not really. And the only people that I found in the Bible that did any kind of forecasting at all had this little rule attached to them. If they weren't 100% accurate, then they're not from God. And you know what you have to do with somebody that isn't 100% accurate. It's like, and I thought, well, sort of a dangerous profession to be in the Old Testament. What is the sort of New Testament manifestation of that kind of profession? And I thought to myself, well, should I even be in this business of trying to see the future? And once in my church, I introduced myself as a modern-day fortune teller. That didn't go over very well. So I had to back away from that and say, well, is there anything sort of like that in Scripture? And in the book of Esther, there was a group of people around the non-Christian king Ahasuerus, non-godly in a lot of senses, but he had a group of people around him that knew the times. And I thought, okay, there is a role for somebody who actually knows the times. Well, that's a big stretch from somebody who's involved in macroeconometric forecasting, and so I still wasn't sure how to tie those two things together. But I thought to myself, you know what? I've been given a passion for this, and I was given the ability inside of school to put this together, and I know who knows the future. And so I thought, okay, let's see where this thing goes. So throughout my career, I first of all started in current analysis. I was working with one of the premier research institutions inside of Canada, working with highly mathematical models and trying to get my feet wet in this profession, figuring, okay, that's the way that I can actually make a go of it inside of all of this. And so economic forecasting really has been what I have done over the last little while. And so you might say, okay, well, let's stand back from that and think about the kind of world that we've lived in the last little while. That must be a tough business to be in, and indeed it is. Because if you count up the number of unprecedented things that have happened over the last, I would go back 20 years and say, you know, take all of economic history, you can put on a very cogent list a number of things that nobody's ever had to deal with before, or they are much more extreme than anybody's had to deal with before. So how do you stand back as a Christian inside of that kind of environment and try to put the pieces of that puzzle together? Well, you do a lot of it on your knees. I remember leaving the Conference Board of Canada to do the job that I'm in at the moment and saying to the folks there, you know, it's not a Christian organization, but saying, I can't think of a piece that I've written or something that I've gone out there and done, but I haven't prayed about it beforehand. I had to share that with them because they had asked, you know, how is it that you've gotten to where you're at the moment, and so forth. There's a list of things that they had. And you know, I had to give God the glory for that. This is dangerous stuff. This is very risky, you know, trying to make bold calls inside of an environment like this. So what kind of environment are we faced with at the moment? Well, most people think, okay, they think back to 2008, you know, the time that you were starting your business. And I don't know if you heard me, but at the table there, I went, whew, boy, that was almost the worst time in the last little while to start a business. Because I know you mentioned 2009. That was really the depth of things. Things were not going very well. This was the largest drop in global GDP that had happened since the Great Depression. And, you know, we had had a 16-year growth cycle that preceded that. Normally, a growth cycle is 8 years. So 16 years on. 16 years is a long time in anybody's career. And you know what? It's just long enough for everybody to forget what down is like. So the biggest down comes along since the Great Depression. And what's everybody supposed to do? We lost our reason. You know, there was all kinds of stuff that was going on inside of financial institutions because of another unprecedented that had happened, and that was the exponential rise in computing technology. Well, there was no industry that was leveraging that rise in computing technology more than financial institutions, and they were using that capability to develop new products at a rate. There was a single institution that had developed 1,000 new products or hybrid products in 1 year. This is an industry, folks, that over the centuries had developed its list of products very, very slowly. So all of a sudden, there was an exponential increase there, and the sophistication in these products were known to very few people that knew high math and knew what a fourth or a fifth derivative actually meant. And so when this started to collapse in itself because there wasn't enough history against which to judge these new instruments, not only were we facing economic collapse, but we were facing full-blown financial collapse as well. And that's something that no economy can handle, much less a globally integrated financial system integrated economy like the one we have today, as unprecedented as all those linkages are. That was one domino falling that was going to send dominoes crashing all around the world. And so this is the context in which you started your business. You know, everything is falling apart. And since then, what have we seen? Well, because we panicked, there was an unprecedented outpouring of stimulus that happened very quickly, within about 6 months of the crisis actually occurring. And this was supposed to lift the economy back up. It was so strong, it was so coordinated, it was so simultaneous that it actually did create the illusion that the world was coming back and getting back onto its feet again. And we said, you know, don't get too excited about this thing. By the way, we saw that recession coming. And then our next prediction inside of all of this was, after you see that first wave of growth, there's going to be all kinds of flat, and it's going to last for a long time. Why is that? Well, we observed that prior to that, there was a bubble of activity that had lasted about 5 years. That was another unprecedented that we had to deal with in our time. Normally, you would get about 2 years worth of surplus happening ahead of a recession. This wasn't just a five-year surplus, but it was a five-year surplus that happened in the context of globalization. Folks, that surplus was exported everywhere. It wasn't just localized in Western Europe or North America. This was something where the consumption excesses of the West, if you like, were exported into the production excesses of emerging markets. And so this was something that transcended the globe, and it was greater in its impact than I believe anything that we had seen prior to it. So it required a lot of stimulus to pull us out of this. The trouble was that bubble was so big that after the first wave of stimulus was over, we got back to the business of working down the excess that we had before, and ergo, we've had 6 to 7 years of what? Of flat. And if there's something unprecedented out there that we don't understand, it's flat. We can deal with down. We're very creative when down happens. You know, necessity is the mother of invention. Or if you like, crisis is the mother of transformation. So we can deal with down. But flat isn't in our DNA. We're wired for growth. So when we're restrained by this, and we're restrained for a long period of time, we have an unprecedented that we have a really hard time dealing with. And so what has that left us with at the moment? Well, we look out of our window at the moment, and what we see is stuff like this happening. 6 to 7 years on, now we're dealing with an extraordinary plunge in commodity prices. Look at some of these percentages. I've indexed everything back to June of 2014. Yes, in oil markets, that's a 60% drop. You know, the other items there, iron ore, you're seeing a 40% collapse. One after the other industry. Gold is in there. Soybeans is in there. Copper. Copper is the red metal that economists gave a PhD in economics to because it was very good at predicting where the economy was going to go. Look at that red line up there. Does that make you feel happy? It doesn't look like things are going particularly well. So that's the commodity space. To that, you can add the currency space. There's a lot of upheaval that's going on inside of currency markets. You can look at other indicators that are out there. This is a popular one by the CBOE called the VIX. It's an indicator of volatility out there. The green line is volatility in oil markets. The red and the blue line, or the black lines there, are volatility in the S&P 500 and volatility in the NASDAQ. And what I don't like about that last one is there's actual volatility in the volatility. This is all there's second-order volatility that we're dealing with. It can't decide whether to be volatile or not. And I'm not sure what to do about a situation like that. Folks, we should have experienced a recovery by now. This is probably the longest period that we've ever had to go through without a recovery. What is going on? And what is a humble Christian forecasters supposed to do inside of an environment like this? How can we actually give advice in a situation like this? Well, we get on our knees, and we crack the books, and we analyze the numbers, and we try to figure out what it is that's going on, and we ask God for wisdom inside of a situation like this. So here we are with the volatility. How can I explain that to you? Well, folks, this volatility is not about weakness. That's where most analysts, if I can say that as humbly as possible, have it wrong. So if it's not about weakness, what is it about? Well, I have to first convince you that there's actually growth out there. There is growth out there. Look at this American market south of the border here. There's a lot that's going on inside of that market, and there are three pillars of growth that are leading to this situation, a situation of very stressed employment markets at the moment. It's probably hard to find good skilled workers in America because there's been a juggernaut of employment growth that's happened on a very consistent basis, driving their unemployment rate down to the point where the Federal Reserve Board is saying by mid-next year, real wage increases are going to be unsustainable. Unsustainably low? No, unsustainably high. And that's something that central banks don't like. When prices start getting out of control, they start getting an itchy trigger finger on the gun of monetary policy and the raising of interest rates. So what is actually leading to that? Three things are going on in the U.S. market right now. First of all, there's a resurgence in the housing market. You know, when the economy flatlined, housing went from construction, annual construction of around 2 million units a year down to 500,000. You do the math on that. Would you have wanted to be in the building industry at that point in time? Nobody forecast that things would be that bad. But that was the extent of the bubble that had built up inside of that market. So there was an underbuild that was chronic at that time. We said, okay, well, that's not going to persist forever. It persisted for 2.5 years, and people started getting really worried about a low growth, low level of activity, new normal. Maybe this is the way that the world is going to be. And we said, no, the rules haven't gone away. There are 1.4 million households created every year, and as soon as the excess is done, that's what the U.S. market is going to go back up to. Do you know what it's at now? It's at 1.2 million units and rising. And it still hasn't bridged that gap to 1.4 million units. That's where it's headed, folks, and it's actually headed higher than that. Why? Because the period of underbuilding has more than exhausted the surplus inside of the U.S. housing market, and so now it's got to rise above 1.4 million units just to keep that deficit from growing and to get it down again. Well, why do I talk about the housing market? Well, this is a great place here in BC to do that because this is a forestry province. But there's more to it than that. Housing is a leading indicator of economic activity. So it argues against that copper line there. Something is actually going on inside of the U.S. market that's really powerful. That's only pillar number one. Pillar number two, this chart speaks to. Look at the amount of employment growth that is happening there. Behind every single one of those multiple 100,000 per month jobs that are being created in the U.S. is an income. And that income is growing at the moment. And it's growing in a way that is not just because of the new jobs, but because there's pressure building up in the market. Real wages are starting to rise. And so there's extra on top of that. Furthermore, Americans are now, after a long hiatus where their confidence levels were at recessionary markers, are now at normal levels of confidence. So they're feeling like spending again. They have the power to spend again. They've reorganized those awful debts that they had way back prior to the crisis. And guess what? They got a $110 billion bonus on top of that this year as a result of lower gas pump prices. So do you think this is a juggernaut that's ready to get going? It absolutely is. And by the way, it's 70% of the number one economy in the world. 13 cents out of every dollar that circulates worldwide starts with this group of people. That's a pretty powerful thing that's going on in the economy. That's pillar number two. Pillar number three is, if you've looked lately at the U.S. Industrial machine, look at capacity utilization rates. They're almost back where they were at the frenzy time. Well, does frenzy and today's economy actually go together? Do you think we're in a frenzy at the moment? Nobody's saying that. But if that's the extent to which pressures have built up inside of the U.S. industrial production machine because everybody feels that they don't have to invest because there's no activity out there, can you imagine what's just about to happen? In fact, it's not just about to happen. It already has happened. I think I've got a chart up here to illustrate that. No, I don't. I wish I did because it's very dramatic. You're seeing enormous increases in capital put in place inside of the American industrial machine. So something is alive and well stateside. The economy is back on its feet again. You would never know it by actually listening to the press. Well, by virtue of the fact that the US dollar is so strong, this is actually being spread to the rest of the world. And so Western Europe has been chronically underbuilding for a long period of time. And this is a chart that I put together to illustrate that, yes, a huge surplus of activity in both the industrial sector and in the residential sector built up, but underbuilding has actually worn that surplus down, and Europeans are starting to invest. Did you know that in the last 5 quarters of GDP inside of Western Europe, they have actually been overperforming their long-term trend rate of growth? That speaks to me of a Western Europe that's actually getting back on its feet again. This isn't all that's happening. There's growth that's happening in the emerging world as well. And so I know that emerging economies are very commodity dependent and they're very worried about what low commodity prices are actually doing to them. But volumes of activity as a result of this, what's going on in Western Europe and what's going on in the United States at the moment, are actually translating over to them. So they may be getting hammered in terms of margins, but the flow through, the actual activity that's leaving the back gate of the plant is rising. I've actually gone into market to verify that this is going on. I've been down to Colombia. I've spoken with people that are under deep duress, supposedly, and they're saying, well, somehow stuff is still happening. Nobody's telling us why, but it's actually happening. Stuff is moving. I was in South Africa last week, same story. they should be deeply underwater, and they're saying, no, we're still optimistic because stuff is still moving. Significant amounts of stuff is still moving outside of our plants. Everybody's worried about China. What's happening to China? China's falling apart at the moment. All the indicators that are coming out of China are looking really gloomy, and they are. I don't want to deny that they are. Don't want to be unnecessarily rosy about what's going on inside of that economy. You have to understand what's happening inside of the Chinese economy to get it. This is China's debt. This is China's trade to GDP ratio. So you add exports plus imports together and put that over GDP, and China's long march for 30 years saw a trend increase in the extent to which trade was driving the economy. So you see that in the green line there. That's the way the trend was rising. But when the bubble happened in the world economy, this just took off. Unsustainably high. But at the time, everybody thought, well, there's at least 4 years where this thing is almost close to 70%. And if you forget about all the points of data that are beyond that, and that's all you have, well, the high-frequency analysts out there say, this must be a new normal. It's a high-level new normal, and there it is out there. And you look at that kind of thing now, and you say, ooh, that looks mighty unsustainable. Along comes the biggest crash in world activity, and if you happen to be a trader with the rest of the world, that's a big problem for you. Well, if you look at China's GDP numbers over that time, ruler flat. Are they cooking the books? They're not cooking the books, because when trade collapsed inside of the economy, the government stepped in with far more enormous stimulus than we saw in OECD markets. Our stimulus was strong at 3.9% of GDP. China's initial package was 13% of GDP. You add monetary stimulus to that, and over the first couple of years of this downturn, it amounted to somewhere between 20 and 25% of GDP. Nobody else did stimulus anything like that. And the miracle of the Chinese economy is that they've kept it going for 6 or 7 years. Now we're seeing the cracks begin to develop, and China's, you know, thinking, okay, well, are we going to shift gears and get back into the trade business here or not? Well, I believe that they're ready and they're poised to do that, but their own currency is standing in their way. That's one of the reasons why we saw a depreciation of the Chinese currency before. You know, it's actually appreciating against all other currencies out there. And until that gets fixed, they might not participate in this. Why do I tell you that? Well, people will point to the China story and say, see, the world is weakening. And they'll try to find anecdotes out there and say, yeah, the world is weakening. And they'll look at every little piece of data that's coming out on an economy to try and find out where the cracks are. Because fundamentally, we don't believe that the world can get back to an old normal of growth and to reasonable levels of activity on the consumption front, on the investment front, and everything that's related to it. Well, I believe that it is coming back. And I've actually stuck my neck out in my forecasts for that, and it won't have been the first time that I've actually done it. This may be the first time I regret it, but what am I trying to say here? I'm trying to make a case for growth, but I haven't dealt with the problem. There's volatility and there's growth. And volatility of the kind that we see normally happens when the economy is falling apart. And so there's something that really doesn't make sense about all of this. And if there's a lot of unprecedented stuff going on, is there a way that we can look into that unprecedented stuff to find an explanation for why volatility and growth going together might make sense? Well, here's my try. And we didn't just invent this yesterday as a means of explaining what's going on. I went back through my decks that I've used over the years, and I found this very chart in a deck that I did in September of 2011. And I think it's significant to note that because nobody was saying it at the time and few are using this means to actually explain and to reconcile what's going on. So try this on for size. Prior to the crisis, companies were very good with their cash. They managed it well on the bottom line and they had healthy balance sheets. So this is the kind of environment that we were in, that we're heading into the crisis with. So the bubble activity, everybody didn't lose their reason. They were lean. They were managing their money well. When the crisis happened, the financial crisis preceding the economic crisis caused us all to do a strange thing. We all decided to put money in our mattresses. In Germany, There were ATM machines that were dispensing little wafers of gold because there was worry that the cash systems of the world were going to fall apart. That's the sort of panic mentality that we had at that point in time. So lots of cash already in the system. Added cash to that, with all of us worrying about cash draining out of the system. And what did monetary authorities do? They said, this is such a bad situation that we need to go back to the Great Depression and find out what we did wrong then. Let's do it right this time around. And that thing was quantitative easing. So on top of a monstrous mountain of cash, another monstrous and growing mountain of cash. And this continued over the years. It's great to have that cash in the system, but that cash had nowhere to go. Why? Well, you and I weren't in a borrowing mood at that point in time. We were cutting up our credit cards. Nobody was interested in mortgages. We'd overdone that globally. And businesses all of a sudden had all kinds of spare capacity, so they didn't need to invest. So you got all this money out there in the system with nowhere to go. So what is this going to do? Well, imagine the average corporation CFO having to face all of those angry shareholders saying, we're not getting yield anywhere else, so we certainly want to get it from you. So don't park that money that you've got inside of a zero interest bearing bank account. That's not good enough for us. So what do they have to do? They have to gingerly get out there. They didn't have regular things that they could invest in, so they get into the bond market. But they go very, very lightly into the bond market. They go into treasuries. Trouble is, all their CFO buddies follow them there. There's so much money inside of the system that they drown this part of the bond market. You know how bonds work. You know, lots of money going after bonds. The price of the bond goes up. The yield goes down. No more yield. Unhappy shareholder. And so what do? Well, you move into the next level of the bond market. Surely if I buy a two-year, I'll get a higher yield on that, and nobody's going to follow me there. Wrong number. Everybody followed them in there, drowned that part of the bond market. And so you move out to 5 years, and the same thing happens. You move out to 10 years or 30 years, and suddenly you're getting worried about tying up your money for that long and not getting compensated for it. But you still have the problem of trying to get yield out there. What are you going to go to? Well, you're going to experiment with some things on the periphery of the market. And these things don't have the same stopgap measures as the bond market. So where do you go? You go to the stock market. You go to currencies, particularly emerging market currencies. You go to sovereign debt. Let's go to the high-yield places that are giving us a 5% or a 6% or a 7% coupon rate. Let's go to corporate bonds. Some of those are pretty dodgy. They've got great high rates. How about dodgy loans? We see that market growing again, and it hasn't gone away. Corporate bonds isn't supposed to be up there twice, so I apologize for that. And where else did this money go? It went into commodities. When pension funds start getting into commodities, folks, you got to examine your pension fund. That makes me really nervous, because when you look at long run 5 minutes to go, okay, I'm not going to be able to do this. You look at long run commodity prices, and this is what they look like. Okay? In real terms, that's what they do. So your pension fund goes into that, you got a problem. So this is only half of the story. Quantitative easing comes in. And I'm arguing that for the last 6 to 7 years, there's been false pricing inside of all of these instruments as a result of all of that liquidity. Why did it persist for that long? Wave after wave of quantitative easing perpetuated the illusion that these prices were actually right. Now, what triggered us onto this back in 2010, 2011? Well, we observed that inside of commodity markets, a funny thing was happening. Usage rates were down because world GDP was in the tank. Inventories were rising, but prices were at almost all-time highs. Does that make sense to you? You don't have to take an Economics 100 course to realize that's completely offensive to your reasoning. And this wasn't only just out there. It persisted for year after year after year. We looked at this and said, something's wrong with this marketplace, and this is how we filled that gap. Okay, so that's only half of the story. All of the literature that came out of the Great Depression was about how to do this thing called quantitative easing. Do you know how much literature there is on how to undo it? Not a whole lot. So we got to talk about that, right? Okay, so let's put this thing into reverse. What happens when you've got all this money parked out on the periphery of the market, and all of a sudden the economy comes along and says, hey, I'm going to need some of that money now for regular activity again? I got a host of consumers, starting in the United States, that are going to need this money. They're interested in mortgages again, believe it or not. Businesses need to invest. They need to access some of this capital that they've parked. And so some of this might actually make its way through the shelves of the bond market, but it doesn't have to. It might just leapfrog the thing altogether. And you know what happens to markets like this when the first few dollars start to leave? Well, if you're a savvy investor, you're just going to leave your money parked there because it's going to crash. And you like things that crash. No, there's a stampede for the exits here, folks. And that's exactly what happened right on time, starting mid last year. What's the trigger point for all of this? Well, you don't have to withdraw quantitative easing if you don't have growth in the economy. But if you have growth in the economy, you better sop up that extra liquidity that's out there, because if it gets into regular activity, it's chasing way too few goods and services out there, and the only response that can happen out of that is runaway inflation. So you got to ring fence that thing so that it's not going to get out of control. That's what central banks are doing at the moment. So not only are companies accessing this money for real activities out there, central banks are trying to control how much, and the Fed principally is trying to control how much of this actually gets out there. What have I just told you? I've just closed the loop between volatility and growth. Growth is a trigger for what's going on out there. So have I helped you? Have I said, okay, well, there's growth out there, so that's great, but we got this volatile situation out there. What's the strategic advice inside of all of this? It's going to be a rocky ride up. Thankfully, we can say up. I can look at you in the eye and say there is fundamental growth out there, and there are good reasons inside of the fundamental economy to believe that this is a period of growth and that we're getting back to growth that is more normal than this new normal stuff that people have been talking about for the last little while. In fact, I've even been bold enough to counsel Canadian businesses to say, look, I think a big wave of stuff is coming our way right now, and I want to make sure that I look at you in the eye and say, you can't accuse me of not warning you that you might get swamped by this growth if you're not ready for it. And they look at me as if I've, you know, okay, I thought you were a Martian before. You really are something from Pluto now, because we haven't seen anything like this in the last while. Could that be possible? Well, I think that really the only thing that has changed the rules inside of the economic continuum is that we have an exaggerated business cycle. We had a huge period of surplus. We had a big recession to get rid of it. We had a protracted period of down because we needed to exhaust that surplus. That surplus is now exhausted, and we're getting back to normal activity now. And that normal activity, given the levels of activity that we descended to, actually gives us very aggressive growth. So that's what I think that we can look forward to. It's a good thing, because Canada's domestic economy isn't like America's domestic economy. It's fundamentally weak. We have heavily indebted consumers. We have an overbuilt housing market. Sorry, but I have to say that here in Vancouver. This is one of the places where way too much real estate activity has gone on. And we have provincial governments, not here, but in the rest of the country, that still need to balance their books. And that requires austerity. So we've got a domestic economy, folks, that's not doing very well. But thankfully, we've got this external economy that's getting on its feet in a big way. Exports is where things are going to be at. Now, I'm from Export Development Canada, so it sounds like a really convenient sales pitch. Just happens to be the way things are at the moment, and I'm the lucky guy that happens to be in the middle of it, you know, saying, well, if you're going to do that, you know, here we are. But folks, I wouldn't make up a story like that for you. I believe that I've been paid all of my career just to go out there and find the truth. And if the truth hurts, I'll tell that. I think the integrity of a Christian economic forecaster or a Christian business person leads them to say, look, I'm just gonna give it to you straight. And you know, there's video of me and our team back in 2008 and 2009, and we were the abject pessimists. You know, I was the guy that back in early 2008 was saying $70 oil by the end of the year, folks. And you know what oil was doing in the beginning of 2008? It was 100 bucks, it was 110, it was 120, it was 130. And I was saying all the way along, 70 bucks by the end of the year, 140, 140, 750 was the peak. And I kept saying, second half of the year, folks. 4 days into the second half of the year, the thing turned the corner. Somebody once asked me in a crowd, $70 oil, really? And I said, you know what? $70 is probably the minimum it's going to go down to. I wouldn't be surprised to see $50 by the end of the year. And they thought, okay, he's really lost it here. You know what it was at the end of the year? $35. Now, I'm no genius. I got a lot of people that work for me that are way smarter than I am. But I'm a Christian economist who looks to the Lord to help me, to give the best advice that I can to folks like you right across Canada and different parts of the world, and I depend on him. And I have an education, and I have a solid background in this, and I've been in the trenches of data, and I got a lot of rules of thumb in my head that guide me as I go along. But he's the one that knows the future. He's the one that guides us. And I may be right or I may be wrong on how I'm calling the economy right now. Don't take this as a sign to put all your eggs in the basket that I've just given you here. I always counsel people, get a lot of advice. But this is the best advice that I believe that I can give you at this point in time. It's hard to get the turning points. We know how to be pessimistic when we have to be pessimistic, and I believe now is the time to be optimistic. I had more that I wanted to say, but I'm out of time now. I hope you found something useful inside of all of this, something inspirational, and Rick, thank you very much for the opportunity to be with you today.